It's again a controverted topic where, on the one hand, we have the Western, you know, contemporary Western history, according to which civilizations arose fairly recently, and they arose. I mean, the first civilizations are supposed to have risen in what is today's Iraq, for, you know, and everyone knows Sumer, Mesopotamia. That's famous. The first agriculture and urban developments arose there. And what is that, about 6,000-7,000 years ago? And then later on also other cultures, civilizations arose independently in Egypt, in India, in China, and in Central and South America. And especially when we talk about the American cultures, they're completely disconnected from the cultures of Asia and Egypt. The idea about America, the American, the population of the American continent, is that most would probably still say 12,000 years ago. Actually, I think as far as I understand it, this idea right now is that actually the northwestern part of America, Alaska and so on, was actually populated already about 30,000 years ago. And there was connection between Siberia and Alaska by the Bering Strait that time the oceans were lower, you know, and then so there were humans living in that area. And then when the last glaciation, you know, ice age stopped, something was like 12,000 years ago, and the glaciers melted, then humans were able to travel down the coast of, you know, west coast of America, and gradually move down and then populate North America, Central America, and in the end, South America. That's a general idea. Whereas on the other hand, we read in Mahabharata and the Vedic literature in general about a worldwide Vedic culture, very advanced civilization we hear about that actually the kings of Hastinapur, they were kings of the whole world. And even many names have been mentioned which can be associated with some of the present countries, like Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam, the Kirat Humanda Purimda Pulgasha verse, where different names of different races or people are mentioned. And said that even they, if we talk about someone out of Vedic culture or not enough, the highest cultural level, even they can become pure devotees by the mercy of the devotees. Devotees can make devotees even from these foreign backgrounds. So there are different races are mentioned, and Prabhupada associates and connects them with Turks, Greeks, Chinese, and like that. And also Prabhupada mentions in other places that and Prabhupada also, in many places, and even also in conversations, mentions that there was a worldwide Vedic culture. I mean, it's, you know, so we had, again, we had a conflict between these two opposing ideas. So, of course, modern historians will conclude that whatever is in the Vedas is mythological, and it's just ancient ancient myths somehow or other, you know, have been collected in some in some old, you know, old books over actually centuries and millenniums. The Vedas also were written. It's also something to do with dating of the Vedas and so on. It's a very, very big topic. So that's what I'm, you know, I'm looking into, and I know that many, actually a lot of devotees are also looking into on a much, you know, deeper scale than actually I'm doing. So I'll try to, you know, look at some of the things that's there. And again, one of the actual problem with this presentation is actually to reduce, because actually material, relevant material is massive. There's so much to present, actually one can give a whole, I think for a whole week one can just speak about, you know, actually there is, when you really start looking at it, there is a lot of evidence that supports the Vedic history and completely contradicts the Western model. So, but it's kind of, I'm trying to limit myself to a few things, and it's just the top of an iceberg that I'm going to present here. So, I thought I would start out with, and it's probably quite known to all of you, a little about how a lost river was found in the 90s. Have you all heard about this? It's quite known, isn't it? Everyone has heard about how the Saraswati River was found actually by satellite photos in the 90s, where it was discovered that it's just to see. Get the idea that actually a great river used to run down through central India from here in the Himalayas. And you see, the Saraswati is running. This is this red one here. Here we have the Indus or the Sindhu River, Yamuna, Ganga, like that, and. There was a very large river running, with, you know, down through central India and into the Arabian Sea, but which has dried out something like about 4,000 years ago, 2,000 BC. It was dry, and it must have been drying out, you know, over a couple of millenniums or something like that before. So we probably have to go at least 6,000 years back in time before this river was, you know, the mighty. Which river is it? Well, I don't know. I think everyone has. It's actually the great Saraswati that is actually was running, was discovered there. That was a very, very significant discovery. Why? Because the Saraswati is a very central. You know, plays a very central role in the Vedic literatures in general, and that's actually one reason why European historians were saying actually you can see the Vedas are just mythological. They talk about this Saraswati River, but there is no Saraswati River. So this shows actually this is just mythological. But well, now they found it, so it seems that it was not so much mythological after all. As it was such a great river. And what's interesting then is that they talk about the archaeologists found the first Indian prehistoric culture was discovered around the Indus River, that they found that excavations in the beginning of the 20th century at what they call Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, and so they named it the Indus culture. But now they actually found out it probably should be called the Saraswati culture, because since the 90s and up to today, archaeologists have actually discovered that the real center of this Indus culture was actually the Saraswati. They found more than 500 sites along the Saraswati, and significantly less power than the Indus River. Actually, looked like Sarsfield was really the center of this culture. And so that is, of course, very, very interesting. And this has everything to do with the idea of the Aryan nation and where do the original Aryan people come from. If we go back, the first time it was discovered it was discovered actually by William Jones. William Jones was the first European Indologist. He was he lived in was it 17, I think died at the end of the 1700s, like that. So he was the first great Indologist. And he was also the one who noticed the similarity between, on one side, Sanskrit, on the other side, Latin and Greek and other European languages. They're very similar. And they clearly are, you know, they are originating from one original language. So then, and which also means actually most European people and Indian people and all those who speak Indo-European languages must have a common origin, must be a common people that we all have descended from. So where does this original people come from? Well, Jones thought it was from India. It's obvious Sanskrit is the oldest known language, and it's pretty obvious, so we must have come from India. But although some European scholars in those days also embraced that idea, so that became a kind of a more unacceptable idea, simply because the fact that Europeans are naturally, not only are they now dominating all the other peoples of the world, colonizing the whole world, but also it's obvious that Europeans by race are superior to all the other inferior races, in terms of, not in terms of culture, but also in terms of intelligence and so on. So it's clear that the Aryans, the original Aryans, can only have come from somewhere in Europe. So that became actually the dominant idea, this Aryan, then the idea was that the Aryans had originated from somewhere in Europe or maybe Central Asia, and with their civilization, they had spread all over in different directions and also come to India and brought civilization to the uncivilized people. India. This idea was first proposed by Max Müller. He was an originator of the Aryan invasion theory. You know, Max Müller was a great Indologist of Oxford, German, but was professor in Oxford many years. He translated something like 51 books from the Vedas, including the Rig Veda, original Vedas, and so many books. He never put his foot in India, though. That's interesting. But Max Müller was never in India. But he was a great age.
He never went to India?
Never. Max Müller was never in India. And also, one thing is, he was, in the beginning, he was paid by the East India Company to present the scriptures of the Hindus in a way so the Hindus would lose their faith in those scriptures. Because he was, it was part of a Christian missionary endeavor. So this Aryan invasion theory was constructed, by him. Okay, he was the first to come up with this Aryan invasion theory. And then, of course, something happened in the beginning of the 20th century with the discoveries of the Indus civilization. Excavations at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro found very advanced prehistorical civilizations, and they were older than the dates. I mean, that's the dates for the Aryan invasion. So, and the Aryan invasion was given just to recap, Max Müller thought that the art had invaded India something like 1900s before Christ, and then 500 years after the Aryans has written down the Vedas. The Vedas are supposed to be written by the Aryans, and they wrote the Vedas. Not all, but they started writing down the Vedas 500 years after something. And so then something like 1500 before Christ, Max Müller assigned the date for the Rig Veda, was written down 1500 years before Christ. And then, you know, so-called Veda writings, he gave, you know, a few hundred years up until, like, you have, you know, Puranas and the Bhagavatam, was a very recent writing according to Max Müller. So now suddenly we had the Indus civilization, and that was dated much older, that was dated 1,000 or 2,000 years older than that. So then actually the Aryan invasion theory had to be changed, and it became instead that a theory that it was actually not civilized, it was primitive nomads, is that the word? That had roamed all over, and these primitive nomads had conquered an advanced civilization in India and subdued the original people. They had and taken over their civilization, and the only thing they had contributed with was their Sanskrit and their caste system. You know, the despised caste system that was what the Aryans had brought to India. So that became the standard Aryan invasion theory up through the 20th century. Of course, and that again, that theory has many, many problems. And the real problem came here with, again, if you look at the discovery of the Saraswati River, because the Saraswati River is a very prominent river in the Vedic literature. And it dried out 4,000 years ago before the Aryans, as opposed to invaders, India, and written down the Vedas 500 years later. So clearly, I mean, an invading, you know, nomads coming 1,000 years after the river has dried up, and then 1,000 years later starts writing down the Vedas. I mean, they cannot have written down the Vedas and written about the Saraswati like that. Clearly, this discovery of the Saraswati River completely, you know, puts the Vedas down to back to a much older age, and it also shows the Aryan invasion theory is actually completely false. It never happened. And there are many, many, anyway, I wasn't planning to get into a huge discussion about the problems with that. One problem is this, the Aryan culture or whatever has never been found. Has never been found any archaeological discoveries in Europe, in Central Asia, of any Aryan people or anything like that. There's no archaeology whatsoever of any Aryan civilization or whatever. Only found in India. And it has many, many problems. It was actually basically, you know, motivated theory to save Europeans from having to admit that actually we originate from India. But it's, I mean, this discovery of Saraswati puts us way back again, and you know, documents that the most simple and rational explanation of, you know, hypothesis is that the original Indo-European people, so-called Aryans, actually came from India and issued out from India.
When did they discover Saraswati?
It was in the 90s, 1990s, something like about 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So it's satellite photos, you know, it's a satellite, you know, filming, and then actually you see there's a dry out riverbed running through areas which now are desert-like, you know, it's,
And the Aryan invasion was based on the linguistic
only. There's a similarity of European and Indian languages. They must have had a common origin. and it's all based on that. Yeah.
Didn't Sarasvati also go underground, Prabhupada mentioned? Is it totally dried out, or is it under the surface?
I mean, as I understand, there's still some glacier that's, I mean, some in the Himalayas, there's still some stuff on the river, but now it goes underground and dries out. Mm-hmm. So the glacier seems to have receded or something, so actually it's, I think is it sometimes in the rainy season that still this dry riverbed runs? I mean, there's a small river that still, but not like it seems like this. They say actually the Sarasvati is when its height was bigger than the Ganges, much bigger than the Ganges, which was a massive river.
Well, was it an accident that they found Sarasvati when they were looking for?
I don't know. In the Madhva Maharaj, you know?
I don't know that. They say that along the shores of the river bed, the water there is special, it's a good quality. I mean, when you drill down in the earth. So there is, so to say, something underneath the earth going on still.
Yeah.
So we can say that the river is running under the earth.
That's probably so.
Because along that area there is wells and they have nice water. There's wells with water.
Although the area is actually otherwise quite a dry area.
Something.
So
it's interesting that there is three schools in the lodges. Soviet school in the lodges. There was German and English. And when I was young, I was quite also interested in this, because this Rusi Hindi Bhai, this Russian and Indian relationship was very strong, and they are very strong this in the logical also, also this school.
And when I come to this school, the Aryans came from Russia.
There was arguing with this Western school about the dates.
Okay.
When it was coming. But it's very interesting that this Russian in the logical school, they have scientific research of the animals, for example bees, and there was writing that first bees, domestic bees, 30,000 years they was like created, and then they 10,000 years before they was developed to the domestic, and then 3,000 years before this era, they was coming from India to the all over the world. Okay. This honey, no, the, no, I was.
So the honeybee originates from India.
The domestic bee, and they have a lot of also about the cows also. And therefore, this Russian Indological, no, they studied also animals, and therefore they like little bit contradict the Western, because they do only linguistic.
Yeah. So you see, there's so much studies of these things being done. Western ideas, there's a German school, and of course that had some very dire consequences, because there the idea was that, so where did the Aryans come from and who were the original Aryans? And then you had a whole Nazi ideology build up around that. It was this Aryan invasion theory and its implications is not only something that happened in some historians and universities. It had massive political consequences. The Germans embraced it. We are the original Aryans that theory is not. Sarasvati proves that we are not the Aryans, even though we are light skinned and blue eyes. We are not the Aryans. So much for this. Yeah. And there's been written an awful lot about that. Here, I have another topic I've been looking at into. Here's Buddha, according to standard theory, was born in 563 BC and died in 483 BC. And Buddha's dating is very significant because Buddha is generally, when we talk about prehistory and historical times, the, you might say, the mark is actually Buddha. It's considered actually the Buddha can be dated quite precisely before that everything is uncertain, and after Buddha we have you know, quite good historical records, written records, and so on. And I think that everyone, I mean, is there any problem with this dating? We all, I mean, this is the date we all know. But as you see, I've written here in question marks. Because actually, well, at least we should ask, how did we get this date, 563 BC? But it turns out, actually, the dating was, again, goes back to William Jones, the first Indologist. And he dates it on the basis of actually Alexander's invasion of India, and his and when he came to India, you know that also Prabhupada writes that he was confronted by Chandragupta, and Chandragupta stopped him, and of course we know there's a whole you know, the Chanakya, his minister, was his advisor, and he's giving also this example that, you know, a strong king like Chandragupta, because he had a strong Brahmana behind him. And Buddha is a precedes king, came in the same dynasty as Chandragupta and precedes Chandragupta. So then from Chandragupta, William Jones could go back to ultimately to Buddha and have him dated like that. And then from Alexander lived in have it here. Alexander, this is his date, 356 to 323 BC. So from that, on the basis of Alexander's invasion of India, Buddha's date was, has been calculated by William Jones. But there's one thing here that, and not many historians in West are even questioning that, but in the last couple of decades, some Indian scholars have been asking which Chandragupta did Alexander actually make, because there was not only one Chandragupta. There were at least two, and so there were three. There was Chandragupta Maurya, who is Chanakya's Chandragupta, and then there's a later Chandragupta who founded the Gupta dynasty. And there's actually the 1200 years difference between them. Which Chandragupta did Alexander meet? William Jones assumed it was Maurya Chandragupta. But there are reasons to think that he got wrong. It was the wrong Chandragupta. And some of the reasons are, I mean, there's many arguments, but just a very simple one is, if you have here, that Chandragupta Maurya, he was preceded by Mahapadma Nanda, and he was a king that, you know, this useless king that, you know, mocked Chanakya and so on. And so he was preceded by Nanda and succeeded by Bindusara. And Chandragupta was preceded by Chandrasri, and he was succeeded by Samudra Gupta. Now, according to Greek records, historians they concluded that Sandra Kotos is a Greek name for Chandragupta, and according to the Greek histories, Sandra Kotos was preceded by Sandramas and succeeded by Sandro Kryptos. So, and what is striking here is that the names of his predecessor and successor don't match in any way to the names of the Chandragupta Maurya's predecessor and successor. But Chandra Sri, and he's actually also called Chandra Ma So it's actually very close to that. And Samudragupta and Samudragyptos, they're very similar. And there are also other reasons to believe actually it was probably Chandragupta Gupta that Alexander met. For example, Alexander did not come to a Buddhist India, he was a Hindu India, if you call it, use the word Hindu. A Vedic India he came to. That's not really, and that's striking because he should have after Buddha. There's King Ashoka in the third generation after Buddha, and he's spreading Buddhism on a large scale. And then Buddhism is prominent in India until Shankara, who drives Buddhism outside the borders of India. So if Alexander should actually have come to a Buddhist India, but he was a Hindu India, which means, because they're also a little suspicious, which indicates actually that when Alexander came to India, Shankara had already been there. But the thing is that actually the dating of Shankara is also connected with this whole dating of Buddha. Simply line them up, and then we have the dating of Shankara around, is it 800 or something like that, after Christ, quite recently actually. But if they got it wrong, if they got the wrong Chandragupta, that means actually they are off by 1200 years, and everyone has to be moved back 1200 years. That means also Shankara, who actually was rather living in, that makes it something like 600 before Christ actually. And Buddha is around 1700 to 1800 before Christ. And actually the whole history has been shifted. And what's interesting there, if that is actually the case, and you actually can move history back 1200 years like that, suddenly the chronologies of kings and so on, giving in the Mahabharata and other places, suddenly they're much more in line. And than they used to, and it's now assumed, which is also brings the Vedic text within the realm of history and not prehistory or myth. So that's quite interesting. So there's something there. It's a topic that really needs to be researched a lot more. I think someone have already done it. It should be researched a lot more. Someone is. Want something to do some research. If someone would like to take a PhD in something, I think it's a topic that could be could be very interesting to research. Because then suddenly we have the layers are within the realm of history, so it has again great implications. This fact, this apparent mistaking of the dating of Buddha with the wrong Chandragupta and so on. Any comments on this?
These
records are available. Historical records, recorded by the Greeks.
But it's
available.
Yeah.
Alexander had one historian with him. That were writing things, writing. I don't know if even Aristotle wrote about Alexander. There was contemporary, and also there were regular communication between India and Greece over the next centuries. So that we do have Greek records of India. I don't know the details beyond that.
I just wondered who now are those who are suggesting that this is...
Who are they? I have a couple of references here. Indian historians. Indian historians, yeah. And also others, I'm sure. But so I have at least this example I've gotten from one Indian historian in an article. Mm-hmm. Most of this is on the internet. Mm-hmm. You can find it also.
And there is an interesting story about Alexander. There is discussion about Pankration, if you know this Greek, the Greek martial art, Pankration. And there was ideas that Alexander, he brings this Pankration to the India, this martial art, because in Vijayanagari kingdom, there was one Catholic, this traveler, he described how the Kshatriyas, how they fight. And this is like Pankration rules. But at the same time, if you read in Krishna book how Krishna kills Chana Rukmustik, it's also like Pankration rules.
Okay.
So and the question is, because when Alexander came, Vasudeva Krishna is already known.
Yeah.
So this is the question, who brings Pankration to Greece?
Yeah.
like this, all these rules, because this Vasudeva Krishna, this free fight is already existed. And therefore there is so many discussion about this, that if he came today and his generals, they accepted Krishna as God, if you know. And the describing of this Pankration rules exists in the Mahabharata.
Yeah. Has there very often been assumed by European historians as certain, I've been looking at the same thing with astronomy, and they have often assumed that Indian astronomy was imported from Greece, but I know Sadaputta was looking into that, and he says actually either they have risen independently, or the Greeks have taken the astronomy from India, because actually it can be dated, again, further back than the Greeks. Contact with India. So, there seems to have been different connections in the ancient world, probably also before Alexander, and ideas from, have been spreading. So where do the ideas originate from? And people, of course, argue that they did originate from India. Many things. I think someone could really start studying and find so many examples actually must have come from India. Okay. I'm going to have a... This is interesting. This is a Baalbek in Lebanon, where it's something like 70 kilometers northeast of what is called Beirut. There is an ancient, not that ancient, it's from the Roman time, there was a great monument, temple complex for Apollo in the Roman Empire. It was an incredible, magnificent temple for Apollo. And Romans from the whole Roman Empire, including the emperors, used to go and worship Apollo at the Baalbek complex. Baalbek is, the Roman structure is of course from around, it's about 2,000 years old, but it is built on a very much older structure where we find actually the largest stones of megaliths. But anywhere in the world, megaliths are just big stones, and you find them all over the world, weighing a few hundred tons, and like that. But the biggest ones in the world, they found here, on the foundation which the Apollo Temple is built on. There are three massive stones. One there, one there, one there. What happens? Lifted up something like 6 meters of elevation, and then placed next to each other so precisely you cannot even get like a needle or a knife in between them. And their weight is about 800 tons each. For information, a Boeing 747 weighs something like 350 tons, just to compare. So something like 2.5 Boeing 747 that has been actually been transported 1 kilometer from a quarry and then lifted up to this height here. I'll show you here are one more picture. And here are in the same quarry there are actually two even bigger ones. This one weighs actually 1,100 tons. But they were never moved. We have them here. They were not moved. So the ones that were moved were a little smaller, but still massive. So sometimes in the ancient prehistory, someone were cutting out stones like this and moving them, and then lifting up in 6 meters high. I found a company that because I was writing about. Then I found a company in Denmark are doing what they call lifting with cranes, for companies, and asked if they could. I asked them, I need to move a rock, 800 ton rock, 1 kilometer, and lift it up in 6 meters high. Can you do that? And the lady, she said that, sure, we'll do it over several times. Said, no, it has to be moved in one piece. And this is my goodness. I don't think we have any cranes in Denmark that can lift that much. You probably have to get some from outside. And then she asked, where is that storm? And then said, 75 kilometers northeast of Beirut. And then said, are you joking? And then explained to her, that was a little joke, but I was all serious because I was trying to figure out, can we lift stones, rocks like that, or weights like that? So then I got to speak with an engineer, and he explained to me actually that nowadays you can, but actually until the 70s, 1970s, the biggest cranes on Earth could lift something like 400 tons. But within the last decades, they have increased the capacity. So actually now there are cranes in Chinese shipyards that actually can lift 20,000 tons, because it's a lot more. So so somehow they could probably lift 800 tons nowadays with modern technology. But in 1970, not. This task they couldn't have done in 1970. And what to speak without modern technology, modern cranes? How did they lift them? A colleague has had an idea that 40,000 people were involved in it. Moving these 1 kilometer over this terrain. But again, it has certain logistic problems. How do how to get 40,000 people? And what did they pull them on some kind of logs? Did they roll them over or drag them? And the thing is actually, it's such a weight that the whole ground has to be specially, leveled and what is called strengthened. Yeah, it has to be. Because otherwise, the whole thing just sinks. And there is no evidence that the terrain has anyway been leveled and strengthened or whatever. There's no evidence like that. That's not happened. So actually, what has happened here? What civilization is it that was able to move rocks like that? And it's not. This is just the most striking example. But you find these massive megaliths all over. Although, if it was a question of building, foundations, they could cut them up in smaller pieces and transport them. But they didn't. I was excuse, no problem. And as we find buildings like this all over the world, which is actually, I say, evidence of some kind of very, very advanced culture, worldwide culture. And how they did it, we don't know.
Mantras,
we would say. But.
But I read that the Romans had actually quite advanced cranes. Maybe not for that.
They could lift something maybe 100 tons. So they had the obelisks they were moving from Egypt and like that. Mm-hmm. And but they were not anywhere close to this, to these stones here. But they had, they would move obelisks and. But I don't know where they are. They have this, not this capacity than that. That's for sure.
Well, they had some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, Romans were actually very great stone builders. No doubt about that. But there was a previous civilization that was able to move much larger stones than the Romans.
Well, then my question is about the Eastern Islands, because that's like a mystery, this mysterious
also thing.
But that is when Tor Heyerdahl went there, then the locals actually showed them how they could move the species and actually put them up.
Also. Yeah, they're
not that big.
No, I mean, I think, I haven't checked it precisely, but some tons each. They're quite big, but it's, I don't know exactly. And also we find them, I mean, even here in Scandinavia, if you have from, you know, the Jettegrave, also here they move quite big stones. East Island, by the way, there's another interesting. There's an alphabet from the East Islands that I came across. One place that actually the alphabet is the same alphabet found in the Indus Valley, but I haven't got it confirmed like that. I just came across and I never saw it again. But that's.
But Prabhupada teaches also needs yoga, that everything diminishes. So if this is from Dwapara, people must have been bigger than this.
So that, you know, again, corresponds nicely to the Vedic explanation.
Any idea how old these megaliths were?
No.
You cannot do coal 14 on them.
No, that you can only do on organic things. Yes, exactly. Stones you cannot date by carbon 14.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
But this must be for previous yoga then.
Yeah, it's clearly Dwapara Yuga technology we're dealing with here. And again, all these monuments worldwide, they seem to be clearly Dwapara Yuga technology. Which brings us to another thing I've been looking at. Here we are in Egypt. The famous Sphinx and the Great Pyramid behind it. And I'm not going to get into a lot of. I mean, the connection between India and Egypt is actually quite obvious in many ways. And there can be much. I mean, generally, I say the evidence is actually did originate from India. At least they were connected. The Vedic culture, we know that. The pharaohs actually married into Vedic culture. One of the countries in the old Middle East was Mitanni, which is somewhere around Syria, like that. And that's known, that was a Vedic kingdom. They were Hindus. And one princess of Mitanni marries one of the pharaohs. So they were definitely. No, they were part of the same culture. A lot of the ideas in the religion are also very much, at least reminiscences of Vedic religion, worship of sun and many things. And furthermore, the Egyptians have the idea that they actually came from somewhere else. In India, the Veda says not the idea that the Vedic people came from somewhere else, but the Egyptians have in their writings that came from somewhere else, and so on. But I wasn't going to really look at that. I was mainly going to look at the age of there's something interesting about the age of, particularly the Sphinx, and probably that also applies to the Great Pyramid. And actually the three great pyramids here, Giza, and also other monuments in Egypt. The general dating standard idea about date is, we're talking something about, they were built and carved out by the Sphinxes, you know, it's still the largest statue carving on the planet, isn't it? It's actually, a small hill or mountain that has been carved out in one, into one statue. And standard idea is it's originates something like around 4,000 years back. Yeah.
I read some years back that also scientists have claimed that this is not the original head, it's other dimension that it's coming up.
It's probably, there's good reason to think like that. The origin was a lion's head.
Mm.
And in the later ages, someone carved out and gave it the face of a pharaoh at that time. And actually, also you can see that the head actually looks quite younger than the rest of the body. This erosion on the head, so there's reason to think actually originally it was a lion's head.
Mm.
And there's also a reason to think why. It's actually a lot older than standard archaeologists they would admit. And the reason is precisely because of the erosion on the Sphinx. And the erosion is interesting because it is actually water eroded. I don't know if it's quite clear here, but if you get very, very close, actually it's water has been running down massive. There's been massive rains. And must have been for centuries and thousands of years, rains have been, you know, issuing down over the Sphinx and eroding it. And there has not been rains like that in Egypt within the last 4,000 years. We have to go back at least something like 10,000-11,000 years when there were rains like that. So that's actually indicates the Sphinx must be a lot older, and also the Great Pyramid must be a lot older. This was there was one American geologist, and this was an assistant like that, actually got permission to go and investigate the Sphinx, and then they presented one year in 1992, I think it was, a paper at the American Geological Society or something like that, you know, the big geological association of America. And they presented their research, the study of the Sphinx, and concluded that it must be 11,000-12,000 years old, something like that. And all the geologists, they were just saying, bravo, that's interesting, they had no problem with that. And then they were, anticipating, what do the archaeologists say to that? They'll probably also be happy to with this discovery. What do they reply to that? And then, as a reply, I think one of the world's leading Egyptologists, and he was probably still, I think, still living, professor from Chicago. He came and replied, and his reply was, it's not possible because we do not know any culture that existed 12,000 years ago, so therefore it cannot be that old. That was it. And of course, the geologists were not satisfied, and particularly the geologists who did this study, they just replied, this is not our problem. Why have you overlooked that for so many years? We can just see it's that old. You have to find out where that culture was. But again, in Egypt, you have evidence of a very, very ancient culture. And actually, what's interesting now, that's one of the greatest archaeological discoveries within the last decades. That actually they have discovered now they admit they were in the at least like 12,000 years ago, there must have been some people who were very advanced in carving. It's a discovery in Turkey. If we are here, this is Turkey, you see up here, and here's a detail here, and it's, I think it's called Anatoly, at a place called Göbekli Tepe. They have found actually a large stone complex, which they now can say for sure was something like 12,000 years ago old. It's a complex something like this, which it turned out they found it was a hill, but it was actually first a shepherd who found some stones which looks interesting, and he contacts an archaeologist, and then they had ultimately some German archaeologists start excavating this, and what they thought was something like a Middle Ages, some complex from the Middle Ages, turned out is actually the oldest, I mean now what they recognize as the oldest archaeological site in the world, and something like 1,000 years old. And it was a very massive complex that was deliberately buried at one point, and somehow it was abandoned, it was buried. It seems like to create such a large hill must almost have been as big a job as to build it in the first place.
Yeah.
And then for many thousands of years it was under this artificial hill. Here we have Klaus Schmidt, who's a German leading archaeologist, heading up this excavation. And here are some of the pictures, some of the, they're finding these again. As far as I can gather, they are around 3 meters tall. Probably there's stained roofs. I found 45 of these pillars, if this is what they are. And many, many intricate, you can see over there, carvings on these pillars. And so 12,000 years ago, there were some very advanced stone workers operating in Turkey. So that also suddenly puts it back. Actually, there must have been someone who could also have done the job of the Sphinx and so on. And to go back among it, the whole thing with the pyramids and like that.
The important point with the pyramids, it's not the building, so with the city. The pyramids corresponds with Vasco principle.
Yeah.
The Bosnian pyramids, okay, that discussion, the Vasco school in USA using that example of establishing how we use Vasco. I mean, that is another way of placing them. I mean, the square that they're following the principles. So there, that connection with the...
Yeah.
And maybe also then with the temple construction.
Yeah. And that's interesting because it's... Actually, the next thing I wanted to look at was about America, Vedic culture in America. When I started looking at this, I thought that's going to be a hard one to establish connection between American culture and Indian culture. Even Devamaswamy wrote a book, Searching for Vedic Indian, which is an interesting book, but he doesn't talk right about America, so I thought this is a very difficult one to establish. It turns out it's not really.
There are, I remember when I lived in India, I went to Calcutta Book Fair, it was one, I don't remember his name, but he wrote a book called Hindu America, how he claimed the Indians had went over.
Yeah.
And then it was, I think, Paraguay, Ecuador, and some other countries, how he found these stone carvings of Ganesh, of Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he was chauvinistic and he was biased.
But this is what I'm from sure now.
Okay, thanks.
Some of us. No, that's okay, no problem. but Maharaj, you just mentioned Vastu for the pyramids. Here, we are now at Machu Picchu. And in 1995, you could read a long article about how one of the leading Vastu architects, what's called Ganapati Stavati, you see a picture of him there. He had for many years wanted to go to America and look at some of the great monuments in South America and Central America. And here, this article was writing about his results. And one of the results was that he measured buildings at Machu Picchu and found that actually they built according to Vastu. Should we read them out loud for everyone?
Yes.
So it says, Sri V. Ganapati Stavati, let's go over here, has just measured with tape, compass, and a layout story poem two ancient Incan structures at Machu Picchu, a temple and a residence. He has confirmed that the layout on these structures, location for doors, windows, proportions of width to length, roof styles, degree of slopes for roofs, column sizes, wall thicknesses, etc., all conformed completely to the principles and guidelines as prescribed in the Vastu Shastras of India. Residential layouts are identical to those found in Mohenjo-daro. The temple layouts are identical to those that he's building today and that can be found all over India. So Machu Picchu was built according to Vastu. And he was also measuring other buildings at of the Mayans. Mayans was a culture in Yucatan and is a Guatemala and that is Central American culture. And he found similar, but also there the houses are built according to Vastu. Not only that, but they're also using similar building techniques. They use mortar, what's called?
Cement.
Yeah, is that cement?
I think so.
Or calcium more. Some kind of cement to build with, and also to plaster the buildings. And they used to color them the same way that they find in India and so on. So we concluded we are dealing with clearly the same culture. That's it. And now that's actually, in one sense, it's not a new idea that actually we are dealing, you know, that American cultures are offshoots of the Vedic culture. Again, if you go back to William Jones, first Indologist, he also studied some of the American cultures. He said they're the same, they're Hindus over there. Similarities not only in architecture, but also in religions, ideas of the gods, astrology, so many similarities are there. It's actually, that's why I said, you know, to actually start, you know, how do we present the material in such a short time? Because actually, when you get into America and compare it to India, there's everything is, you know, there's so many similarities in, they have yugas, if you take the Aztecs of Mexico, they have the same yugas, four yugas, and the Aztecs gave the colors to the yugas, white, yellow, red, and black, I think. Something same as the Vedas. Must be the other, is the other way around. White, red.
No, it's white, I think.
Right.
Black is calling the lowest.
Black is calling. And have the idea that the yugas are ages are cycling and so on. He said that there's no question. These are the same. These are the same people. Humboldt was another. He was a German politician. Was he minister of foreign affairs and a discoverer and a historian at the same time. He also wrote it. Actually, they are the same culture. And it turns out that up to this very day, they are still historians, they are a minority, they are marginalized, and so on, but they say, no, it must be the same culture. You know, it must be an offshoot of Vedic culture, so, you know, from Southeast. There's so many similarities. Here, you compare temple structures from South India with the temple structures of the, I think this is the Mayans, Mayan temple structures of Yucatan, you know, again, very similar, you know, the pyramids, of course, one immediately associates the pyramids of Mexico and so on with the Egyptian pyramids, but actually they also look very much like the temple structures of India, particularly in South India. the game Pachisi, that's one of the big exams, is, they don't play Pachisi. It's a game. I don't even know how to play it. In India, they play pachisi, and when Europeans came to Mexico, they found that the Mexicans played patoli, same kind of board game. I mean, that cannot be coincident. They can't have risen twice a game like that. It's the same game. Elephant heads found in many American structures and temples. They find here you see there's trunks, elephant trunks. An elephant head is here, if you see it there, and here you can see this here, two elephant heads. And it's interesting, these are Indian elephants, not African elephants, not mammoths, but they're Indian elephants, and there are many elephants' heads found on American structures. And there's never been elephants in America. So where do they get inspiration to make elephant heads? So it's here. This is a drawing of the, I think, the Aztecs. It's of a churning of the milk ocean, look like. The only thing is that the tortoise is on top of the mountain. The elements are there. There's a tortoise, there's a mountain. There's a rope that could be a snake that is being pulled by some beings. Stuff like that. And of course, one might ask, and that's generally the assumption that these two continents are simply too far apart. They could not have crossed the Pacific in prehistorical times.
Say so.
Yeah, that's the argument that it's similar to, and we have no evidence that they could cross the Pacific. But that's not true, actually. The records we have of ships in India and Southeast Asia, back 2,000 years ago, actually, they had very large vessels. Actually, the ships 2,000 years ago in India and Southeast Asia were bigger and more seagoing than, for example, the ship that Columbus sailed to America with. The Indians, they were a lot better seamen and shipbuilders than Europeans. Actually, Europeans didn't build ships that could match what was built in India 2,000 years ago, and that's historically recorded until around in the 1700s. So they could have, they did have ships 2,000 years ago and back that could easily cross the Pacific. They were sailing across the Indian Ocean, which is and there was, then they were transporting, they had ships which could transport horses or 1,000 people, 1,000 tons of goods and like that. They had so big ships in those days.
And the Pandava brothers, they took help from America when they were building across that, didn't they?
So. Yeah, but I mean, you don't get modern historians to admit that.
Oh, that's true.
And, some will say that, the name Mayan is associated with Maya Danava, and then you can also find Patades refers to America. And now, I think now we're speculating, I have no opinion there. But it's just that the connection to America is actually not, it actually seems is very obvious. There's very, very strong evidence that actually it was the same culture and there was regular communication between, of course, there can also be mystical powers and demons, but even without that, they had ships that could cross easily Pacific Ocean. And the evidence is actually, they must have done that because the similarities in these cultures are so many and so great that they cannot have risen independently. For example, there's this one here. This is some kind of a celestial woman. It's a drawing of a celestial woman from a Sioux legend. The Sioux, that's North American, Sioux Indians, spelled S-I-O-U-X.
Sioux.
Sioux Indians. They have a legend that there are four ages four ages are progressing, and for each age there's a bison that loses a leg for each age, and now it's only standing on one leg, the bison ox. And again, we're back in the Bhagavatam. So how can that be, this similarity? That can bring us to the point also, if you want to look at evidence. Actually, many, many legends and what we call myths from all over the world have many similar traits. For example, this is a drawing of a Norse mythological figure, Surt. Surt. Yeah. He's a kind of mystical figure. He's at the bottom of the universe. At one point, he gets angry, and fire emanates, and he destroys the universe, and something like that. So, I know Sariputta said, sounds like Sankhya. Sounds like Sankhya. But Norse sagas do not get in detail. He's a quite mystical figure. But again, Norse. In the Norse tradition, you also have four ages. As far as I know, you have four castes, not stinger. You have quite many similarities. Actually, in the Aztecs, if you go back to America, the Aztecs have four divisions of people, priests and like that. Yeah?
There's a lot of description of universal form in the Norse.
Okay.
The hairs of the is the mountains. There's a being called Bu, also the Bu. And the mountains are the bones. And not the full description, but this same.
Yeah.
So. Demigods correspond to.
There is an interesting point that you said that we are not aliens.
Yeah.
But actually, if we, no, like also if we look, there is archaeological evidences, linguistic evidences, but there is also traditional evidences. Like,
yeah.
For example, I don't know, you know or not, but for example, Latvians, they have this dainas, old folk songs.
Yeah.
They have 2 million dainas. 2 million dainas.
2 million.
Yeah. And they was written down in 18th century. 18th to 19th century, there was this movement when they write down.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1820 to 1870. They was written down all these dance, and they the crusaders, they invade Latvia in 11th century.
Yeah.
And how they calculated that there is older dance by the traditions.
Yeah.
Because when crusaders invade, they forbidden certain traditions, for example, kidnapping wives. There is one like thousands of the dainas who describe kidnapping of the wives, going to the north after the seas and taking the wives like that.
Yeah.
But very interesting is also that there is dainas who said who used the word arisks. Araishi, who use the word Brahmani, Brahmanas, and no one can describe this from the nationalists, because they as you say, you ask, it's coming from Russia, oh, that means that Russians think that Aryans come from Russia, yeah, but no one can describe this, and therefore there is one Diana where it is said, that Sayayush Brahmanish Zilakal Galinya, the Brahmanas, they come together to the blue mountain under the holy tree, and they put their swords under the tree. Under the tree. And actually, if we look these traditions, if we go to the tradition, then we can see that Brahmanas with the swords, they are descendants of Parashuram. you know, like this tradition. There is no other explanation on this. Like, and the same, the Russians, they have this also tradition, very interesting tradition, songs, how they, and also the arisks, the word arisks in this dynasty never meant nationality or the people, it meant qualities.
Okay.
It's qualities. Arisks Ozos, this is Aryan walk. He looks like Aryan, no, it's interesting, and therefore I think maybe there was a lot of aliens between the peoples around the world. Because aliens, it's not nationality, but this is like status, equality.
Yeah. And it's, it's described also, for example, at the... What is that? It's in the first canto. The sages are, you know, gathering from all over the world, is it for Maharaj Parisi's departure? So one of the sages, is it Trita? Is hailing, probably, right? Hailed from the Western European countries. So, so there was, I mean, according to Bhagavatam and Mahabharata, so on, you know, they were part of the Vedic culture somewhat. Maybe some a little uncivilized, but still there were many. There were sages there. There was Vedic culture there.
Some part of Vedic culture.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Some maybe not
derived. Yeah. I mean, I mean, I've seen some devotees think actually the whole thing, the worldwide Vedic culture collapsed with the battle of after the battle of Kurukshetra. At that time, it scattered, and because all the kings, so many kings were killed. And this worldwide, one culture, one political unit broke into many, many pieces.
But why then Bhagavatam is speaking about other races in a bit derogatory terms, you know, like saying that Pulindas, Pulkashas, Andras, Hunas, they can also be elevated,
yeah,
if they engage in devotional service. Yeah. It's like, from one hand, Maharaj Yudhishthira, he's called the emperor of the world,
mm-hmm.
and from another hand, it seems that the Vedic culture is only somehow limited to India, and it's all surrounded by barbarians who also could be elevated.
The Vedic culture is most refined in its pure form in India or Greater India, but the domination is worldwide. But there are, at least it seems like at the time of Yudhishthira Maharaj, there are some, let's say, races or cultures which have dropped below the Vedic standard, and they become malicious and Yavanas and so on.
Even Andras, this is like South Indians.
And Andras, so even there are also uncultured people in India,
mm-hmm.
At that time also. So, but doesn't matter, they can all become pure devotees. So.
Could be that they coexisted if it was, you know, Andras in South India, that they could be civilized groups of people and malicious, you know.
Yeah, it probably was. I mean, we're talking about thousands and tens of thousands and millions of years and millions and billions of people and everything. I mean, it cannot be described exhaustively what has happened there in the past.
Mm-hmm. And as we see now, the history, what is accepted,
yeah.
is. It must be politically correct, and that's not maybe so new phenomenon, but it has been happening also like from the beginning of Kali Yuga, that in certain cultures you keep certain things, you know, like holy or secret or distant,
yeah.
And then in some other cultures it's more open.
Yeah.
In older times, then maybe they talk more openly about baby gods or like that, and then, you know, it became taboo and, you know, like now, you know, it's completely taboo, you know. There's no such thing existing.
And now in history is, I mean, very often, you know, it's the victorious part writes the history. You know. And it's like to see that Europeans wrote the history and everything was Euro-centered. And,
like you showed this picture that there was an incredible structure which had been covered and
mountain. If that's because if the Romans took over an existing structure or just kind of the remnants and built it on top, I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows that actually. If they leveled it, and I don't think Romans. They were that was a major thing with the Christians especially. They were very much, you know, demolishing all heathen temples and structures and like that. That's one problem with America. The greatest genocide, maybe in history, were done by the Europeans to the American cultures, by the Spaniards and Portuguese especially. And they just, what they destroyed systematically, you know, libraries of books. And temples, and they killed and massacred people and like that. So much was lost there at that time. And one last thing of evidence about is something. Of course, this is just a astronomical map of the stars showing the ecliptic, and I used it as an illustration in an article I wrote. No, I did not write. I translated an article by Sariputta where he talks about some you might call them legends or myths, which are found in many, many cultures all over the world. That those the deceased, those who die, they enter the planets of the forefathers at a particular period in the Sagittarius, I think it was in the constellation of Sagittarius, and this story, I might say, you find independently in many, many traditions of the world. And but also what's interesting is that there is a new field of archaeology which is called astroarchaeology. I think you're already familiar with it. That there are, many, many traditions, and especially look at the Vedic tradition, has, there are very precise records of constellations in the and the heavens of planets and stars and sun and moon ascribed to particular incidents. And they are there very much in the Ramayana, and they are there in the Mahabharata. And, until quite recently, until within the last couple of decades before that, there was no way of actually determining what these constellations, when actually they were, if actually they were real, and what period actually they had happened. But now with modern computers and computer software, we can actually calculate now and go back in time. And if we have some particular constellation, we can actually find out when they happened, or when they can have happened. And there are historians and archaeologists who are now using that to give some dates for the, for example, Kurukshetra War, or the time of Lord Ram. It's
Krishna,
the birth of
Krishna, because...
Yeah, I mean, I have one example here. Like also before, I have seen the... this is in Danish, I'm sorry. Someone might have done it for Krishna's birth. But here there's one example of one historian who did it for the Battle of Kurukshetra. It turns out in the Mahabharata,
around the time of leading up to Kurukshetra, some very unusual signs on the heavens happened. Actually, within 1 month, there was both a lunar eclipse followed by a solar eclipse. That's quite rare. You have the same month, total lunar eclipse and total solar eclipse. And then it was described that when Krishna went from Dvaraka, so Hastinapur, to negotiate peace with Duryodhana, and it's described in Mahabharata which days, and this day he went there, and this day he went there. And that is when Krishna is leading, and it's just about, you know, it's obvious there's going to be a war. Then Krishna is followed by Karna. They travel together. And there Karna talks about how inauspicious these signs are. We know, and it's according to, we know which date, he said which day it is. And he explains, look, and translated, it's Saturn is in the, it is close to what is now Antares. I can find, let's see. Here. It says Saturn is. No, okay, it's further up. It's also, Vyasadeva also gives some. Yeah, here it is. It says the Graha Sani, which is Saturn, is hovering around the Nakshatra controlled by Pragyapati. And Nakshatra, it says here, it's a Sanskrit for a sign of the ecliptic. And the sign constellation controlled by Pragyapati is Taurus, and the brightest star in Taurus is Aldebaran. Its Sanskrit name is Rohini. So Saturn at that time is just close to Rohini, and then Mars is moving, has a retrograde move, is moving backwards. His next incarnation says, and he's moving backwards near the sign of Antares. And is moving towards Anuradha. So Antares and Anuradha are two stars in Scorpio. So that's actually very, very precise constellation.
This is from Mahabharata, probably?
It's from Mahabharata, yeah. And these are very inauspicious signs. So Karna is saying this is going to, a whole dynasty is going to be destroyed by, these omens. Also Chitra. Oh yeah, and then there's a Graha that is attacking Chitra, and Chitra is Spica, which is the brightest star in the Virgin, and this Graha is a comet. This story is a comet. There's been some confusion with reading the constellations in the Mahabharata by other historians, because the word Graha turns out it can both mean a planet and a comet. So they couldn't make get to figure out what it meant, some of the Grahas, the planets are described, they have hair. This Dr. Archer concludes these are comets. And actually the word comet comes from the word, a Greek word for hair. We talk about tail, but actually you can also talk about hair, whatever. So the Grahas that are here, actually not planets, they are the comets. So then he says, now we can figure out what actually is. It actually is exact. It's not they're not constituting the different constellations given. And then he calculated when you had these constellations coupled with a total lunar eclipse and a total solar eclipse. And and he came to a date let's see here. Like Saturn in Taurus and near Aldebaran, from you have here, from this period 3000 BC until 1000 BC, there are 85 times when Saturn was near Aldebaran. Then Mars making a retrograde movement near Antares, then suddenly there's only 8 possible times left. And they are given here. And then if you make calculations of possible solar eclipses, where the sun, I must be in an Antares, that leaves us only 2 years, two possible years, 3067 before Christ and 2883 before Christ. And then he also calculates the death of Bhishma, which took place in a certain when what is called winter solstice was in a particular nakshatra, and combined somehow he doesn't get the lunar eclipse in this calculation, although it is here. And then he gets this actually what happened was in 3067 before Christ. This corresponds to the actual dates given for the writing of the Mahabharata. So there are there's a similar calculation for Ramayana also. Of course, that conflicts somewhat what we say it was in Treta Yuga. And that there's some correspondence with constellations from Ramayana around 7,000 years back or something like that. But that's the historians are working on these things, and some, of course, very interesting things are coming out of that. Anyhow, I mean, it's just scratching the surface and many interesting things. I'm just myself reading. Many of you have read a lot of similar things, know more about these things than I do. But I hope you find it just interesting.
Yes, very much.
Thank you. And relevant. Also relevant, it's why actually, besides being fascinated by these, but actually ultimately the whole thing is to, increase our faith in the Vedic text. We might have doubts, but coming from why doesn't correspond, and when you see it actually does correspond to story, that you just become stronger in actually is true, the Vedic texts actually are correct also on these points. One actually becomes, and we can convince others, but at least we can convince ourselves, hopefully we can convince ourselves, which actually is the most important, and that's the first thing to do before we can convince others. Isn't it? I mean, we are preaching, but we have to be convinced ourselves. We're supposed to stop here at 5:30. We can take some questions more if you have it. You're also free to leave. Feel free to leave if you need to go.
I can suggest something. Like you show the self in my book. You might show this. People might find it interesting.
I can show that. If no one else has something, so just take. If there's more on this topic, Mataji mentioned yesterday. I show an animation from a cell inside a cell, and she would like to see it again.
All right. Yes. Yes. Tell about the helper so they don't miss it.
yes. But anything else on this topic?
It's a very long topic. Better be
huge. As I say, it's just, in one sense, I feel a little bad about presenting it, but it's fascinating and in the proper. But I would not make a public presentation at a public program, or to speak at the university, of this one. I mean, I'm not at all up to any, don't have the knowledge at all to really do that.
The question was, are you a professor?
Huh?
Are you a professor?
How am I a professor?
Can we call you a professor?
No, you cannot.
But in Darwin's theory, you're a
professor. No, I'm not a professor. I mean, a professor, of course, America, professor just means teacher.
Okay. In Croatia also, they have to say professor so.
Yeah. So that's but if you by professor, that obviously means you have a doctorate, you have a PhD. So okay. That cannot be used, and I don't, and we should not use it cheaply because then you know it would be actually to have a PhD means you have to actually done some original research. I've never done anything original. I actually just gathering what others have. You know, even when you talk about Darwin like that, it's not. I mean, I haven't done any original. I'm just gathering and collecting, more like a journalist, a writer. And Futakano, some years ago, he got an honorary PhD, a doctorate from the University in Budapest. And he is, of course, he's also like a self-taught person, but they gave him this honorary degree. And he was qualified because his work on the forbidden archaeology and you know, research into ancient origin of humans is original. No one, no other scientists have done that before. So that's a qualification to be actually to have a doctorate. You have to do something original. So I would like to have it. That's not that, but it's just.
PhD or not in school.
Not the runner.
And you can and the thing is you can even find some cheap place where you can get some kind of a we are ultimately, you know, we can impress some, you know, common people, but if anyway we want to get in touch with a you know, top intellectuals, and if and they will actually ask, so where did you get your doctorate like that? And they found out it's just a like a comedian like that. Then they would say they will not even take your shit. Then you're better off just saying you are what you are, and then we can have an honest discussion of the evidence and like that. It's
Okay. So we may like to promote you somehow.